In the loose framework of a single dialogue, Plato has thus combined two distinct subjects, politics and method. Yet they are not so far apart as they appear. In his own mind there was a secret link of connection between them. For the philosopher or dialectician is also the only true king or statesman. In the execution of his plan, Plato has invented or distinguished several important forms of thought, and made incidentally many valuable remarks. Questions of interest both in ancient and modern politics also arise in the course of the dialogue, which may with advantage be further considered by us. A. The imaginary ruler, whether god or man, is above the law, and is a law to himself and to others. Among the Greeks, as among the Jews, law was a sacred name, the gift of God, the bond of states. But in the statesman of Plato, as in the New Testament, the word has also become the symbol of an imperfect good, which is almost an evil. The law sacrifices the individual to the universal, and is the tyranny of the many over the few. It has fixed rules which are the props of order, and will not swerve or bend in extreme cases. It is the beginning of political society, but there is something higher, an intelligent ruler, whether god or man, who is able to adapt himself to the endless varieties of circumstances. Plato is fond of picturing the advantages which would result from the union of the tyrant who has power with the legislator who has wisdom. He regards this as the best and speediest way of reforming mankind. But institutions cannot thus be artificially created, nor can the external authority of a ruler impose laws for which a nation is unprepared. The greatest power, the highest wisdom, can only proceed one or two steps in advance of public opinion. In all stages of civilization, human nature, after all our efforts, remains intractable, not like clay in the hands of the potter, or marble under the chisel of the sculptor. Great changes occur in the history of nations, but they are brought about slowly, like the changes in the frame of nature, upon which the puny arm of man hardly makes an impression. And, speaking generally, the slowest growths, both in nature and in politics, are the most permanent. Be whether the best form of the ideal is a person or a law may fairly be doubted. The former is more akin to us. It clothes itself in poetry and art, and appeals to reason more in the form of feeling. In the latter there is less danger of allowing ourselves to be deluded by a figure of speech. The ideal of the Greek state found an expression in the deification of law. The ancient Stoics spoke of a wise man perfect in virtue, who was fancifully said to be a king. But neither they nor Plato had arrived at the conception of a person who was also law. Nor is it easy for the Christian to think of God as wisdom, truth, holiness, and also as the wise, true, and holy one. He is always wanting to break through the abstraction and interrupt the law, in order that he may present to himself the more familiar image of a divine friend. While the impersonal has too slender a hold upon the affections to be made the basis of religion, the conception of a person on the other hand tends to degenerate into a new kind of idolatry. Neither criticism nor experience allows us to suppose that there are interferences with the laws of nature. The idea is inconceivable to us, and at variance with facts. The philosopher or theologian who could realize to mankind that a person is a law, that the higher rule has no exception, that goodness, like knowledge, is also power, would breathe a new religious life into the world. See, besides the imaginary rule of a philosopher or a god, the actual forms of government have to be considered. In the infancy of political science, men naturally ask whether the rule of the many or of the few is to be preferred. If by the few we mean the good, and by the many, the bad, there can be but one reply: the rule of one good man is better than the rule of all the rest, if they are bad. For, as Heraclitus says, one is 10,000, if he be the best. If, however, we mean by the rule of the few the rule of a class neither better nor worse than other classes, not devoid of a feeling of right, but guided mostly by a sense of their own interests, and by the rule of the many the rule of all classes, similarly under the influence of mixed motives, no one would hesitate to answer, the role of all rather than one, because all classes are more likely to take care of all than one of another, and the government has greater power and stability when resting on wider basis. Both in ancient and modern times, the best balanced form of government has been held to be the best, and yet it should not be so nicely balanced as to make action and movement impossible. The statesman who builds his hope upon the aristocracy, upon the middle classes, upon the people, will probably, if he have sufficient experience of them, conclude that all classes are much alike, and that one is as good as another, and that the liberties of no class are safe in the hands of the rest. The higher ranks have the advantage in education and manners, the middle and lower in industry and self-denial. In every class, to a certain extent, a natural sense of right prevails, sometimes communicated from the lower to the higher, sometimes from the higher to the lower, which is too strong for class interests. There have been crises in the history of nations, as at the time of the Crusades or the Reformation, or the French Revolution, when the same inspiration has taken hold of whole peoples, and permanently raised the sense of freedom and justice among mankind. But even supposing the different classes of a nation, when viewed impartially, to be on a level with each other in moral virtue, there remain two considerations of opposite kinds which enter into the problem of government. Admitting, of course, that the upper and lower classes are equal in the eye of God and of the law, yet the one may be by nature fitted to govern, and the other to be governed. A ruling caste does not soon altogether lose the governing qualities, nor a subject class easily acquire them. Hence the phenomenon so often observed in the old Greek revolutions, and not without parallel in modern times, that the leaders of the democracy have been themselves of aristocratic origin. The people are expecting to be governed by representatives of their own, but the true man of the people either never appears, or is quickly altered by circumstances. Their ill wishes hardly make themselves felt, although their lower interests and prejudices may sometimes be flattered and yielded to for the sake of ulterior objects by those who have political power. They will often learn by experience that the democracy has become a plutocracy. The influence of wealth, though not the enjoyment of it, has become diffused among the poor as well as among the rich, and society, instead of being safer, is more at the mercy of the tyrant, who, when things are at the worst, obtains a guard, that is, an army, and announces himself as a savior. The other consideration is of an opposite kind. Admitting that a few wise men are likely to be better governors than the unwise many, yet it is not in their power to fashion an entire people according to their behest. When with the best intentions the benevolent despot begins his regime, he finds the world hard to move. A succession of good kings has at the end of a century left the people an inert and unchanged mass. The Roman world was not permanently improved by the 100 years of Hadrian and the Antonines. The kings of Spain during the last century were at least equal to any contemporary sovereigns in virtue and ability. In certain states of the world the means are wanting to render a benevolent power effectual. These means are not a mere external organization of posts or telegraphs, hardly the introduction of new laws or modes of industry. A change must be made in the spirit of a people as well as in their externals. The ancient legislator did not really take a blank tablet and inscribe upon it the rules which reflection and experience had taught him to be for a nation's interest. No one would have obeyed him if he had. But he took the customs which he found already existing in a half-civilized state of society, these he reduced to form, and inscribed on pillars. He defined what had before been undefined, and gave certainty to what was uncertain. No legislation ever sprang, like Athene, in full power out of the head either of God or man. Plato and Aristotle are sensible of the difficulty of combining the wisdom of the few with the power of the many. According to Plato, he is a physician who has the knowledge of a physician, and he is a king who has the knowledge of a king. But how the king, one or more, is to obtain the required power, is hardly at all considered by him. He presents the idea of a perfect government, but except the regulation for mixing different tempers in marriage, he never makes any provision for the attainment of it. Aristotle, casting aside ideals, would place the government in a middle class of citizens, sufficiently numerous for stability, without admitting the populace, and such appears to have been the constitution which actually prevailed for a short time at Athens. The rule of the 5,000, characterized by Thucydides as the best government of Athens which he had known. It may, however, be doubted how far, either in a Greek or modern state, such a limitation is practicable or desirable, for those who are left outside the pale will always be dangerous to those who are within, while on the other hand the leaven of the mob can hardly affect the representation of a great country. There is reason for the argument in favor of a property qualification. There is reason also in the arguments of those who would include all, and so exhaust the political situation. The true answer to the question is relative to the circumstances of nations. How can we get the greatest intelligence combined with the greatest power? The ancient legislator would have found this question more easy than we do, for he would have required that all persons who had a share of government should have received their education from the state, and have borne her burdens, and should have served in her fleets and armies. But though we sometimes hear the cry that we must educate the masses, for they are our masters, who would listen to a proposal that the franchise should be confined to the educated, or to those who fulfill political duties? Then again, we know that the masses are not our masters, and that they are more likely to become so, if we educate them. In modern politics, so many interests have to be consulted, that we are compelled to do, not what is best, but what is possible. D-law is the first principle of society, but it cannot supply all the wants of society, and may easily cause more evils than it cures. Plato is aware of the imperfection of law, in failing to meet the varieties of circumstances. He is also aware that human life would be intolerable if every detail of it were placed under legal regulation. It may be a great evil that physicians should kill their patients, or captains cast away their ships, but it would be a far greater evil if each particular in the practice of medicine or seamanship were regulated by law. Much has been said in modern times about the duty of leaving men to themselves, which is supposed to be the best way of taking care of them. The question is often asked, what are the limits of legislation in relation to morals? And the answer is to the same effect, that morals must take care of themselves. There is a one-sided truth in these answers, if they are regarded as condemnations of the interference with commerce in the last century, or of clerical persecution in the Middle Ages. But laissez-faire is not the best, but only the second best. What the best is, Plato does not attempt to determine. He only contrasts the imperfection of law with the wisdom of the perfect ruler. Laws should be just, but they must also be certain, and we are obliged to sacrifice something of their justice to their certainty. Suppose a wise and good judge, who paying little or no regard to the law, attempted to decide with perfect justice the cases that were brought before him. To the uneducated person he would appear to be the ideal of a judge. Such justice has been often exercised in primitive times, or at the present day among Eastern rulers. But in the first place it depends entirely on the personal character of the judge. He may be honest, but there is no check upon his dishonesty, and his opinion can only be overruled, not by any principle of law, but by the opinion of another judging, like himself without law. In the second place, even if he be ever so honest, his mode of deciding questions would introduce an element of uncertainty into human life. No one would know beforehand what would happen to him, or would seek to conform in his conduct to any rule of law. For the compact which the law makes with men, that they shall be protected if they observe the law in their dealings with one another, would have to be substituted another principle of a more general character, that they shall be protected by the law if they act rightly in their dealings with one another. The complexity of human actions, and also the uncertainty of their effects, would be increased tenfold. For one of the principal advantages of law is not merely that it enforces honesty, but that it makes men act in the same way, and requires them to produce the same evidence of their acts. Too many laws may be the sign of a corrupt and over-civilized state of society, too few are the sign of an uncivilized one. As soon as commerce begins to grow, men make themselves customs which have the validity of laws. Even equity, which is the exception to the law, conforms to fixed rules and lies for the most part within the limits of previous decisions. IV. The bitterness of the statesman is characteristic of Plato's later style, in which the thoughts of youth and love have fled away, and we are no longer attended by the muses or the graces. We do not venture to say that Plato was soured by old age, but certainly the kindliness and courtesy of the earlier dialogues have disappeared. He sees the world under a harder and grimmer aspect. He is dealing with the reality of things, not with visions or pictures of them. He is seeking by the aid of dialectic only, to arrive at truth. He is deeply impressed with the importance of classification. In this alone he finds the true measure of human things. And very often in the process of division curious results are obtained. For the dialectical art is no respecter of persons. King and vermin taker are all alike to the philosopher. There may have been a time when the king was a god, but he now is pretty much on a level with his subjects in breeding and education. Man should be well advised that he is only one of the animals, and the Hellene in particular should be aware that he himself was the author of the distinction between Hellene and barbarian, and that the Phrygian would equally divide mankind into Phrygians and barbarians, and that some intelligent animal, like a crane, might go a step further and divide the animal world into cranes and all other animals. Plato cannot help laughing when he thinks of the king running after his subjects, like the pig driver or the bird taker. He would seriously have him consider how many competitors there are to his throne, chiefly among the class of serving men. A good deal of meaning is lurking in the expression, "There is no art of feeding mankind worthy the name." There is a similar depth in the remark, "The wonder about states is not that they are short-lived, but that they last so long in spite of the badness of their rulers." V. There is also a paradoxical element in the statesman which delights in reversing the accustomed use of words. The law, which to the Greek was the highest object of reverence, is an ignorant and brutal tyrant. The tyrant is converted into a beneficent king. The sophist too is no longer, as in the earlier dialogues, the rival of the statesman, but assumes his form. Plato sees that the ideal of the state in his own day is more and more severed from the actual. From such ideals as he had once formed, he turns away to contemplate the decline of the Greek cities, which were far worse now in his old age than they had been in his youth, and were to become worse and worse in the ages which followed. He cannot contain his disgust at the contemporary statesmen, sophists who had turned politicians, in various forms of men and animals, appearing, some like lions and centaurs, others like satyrs and monkeys. In this new disguise the sophists make their last appearance on the scene. In the laws Plato appears to have forgotten them, or at any rate makes only a slight allusion to them in a single passage. Vi. The statesman is naturally connected with the sophist. At first sight we are surprised to find that the elitic stranger discourses to us, not only concerning the nature of being and not being, but concerning the king and statesman. We perceive, however, that there is no inappropriateness in its maintaining the character of chief speaker, when we remember the close connection which is assumed by Plato to exist between politics and dialectic. In both dialogues a Proteus sophist is exhibited, first, in the disguise of an heuristic, secondly, of a false statesman. There are several lesser features which the two dialogues have in common. The styles and the situations of the speakers are very similar. There is the same love of division, and in both of them the mind of the writer is greatly occupied about method, to which he had probably intended to return in the projected philosopher. The statesman stands midway between the Republic and the laws, and is also related to the Timaeus. The mythical or cosmical element reminds us of the Timaeus, the ideal of the Republic. A previous chaos in which the elements as yet were not, is hinted at both in the Timaeus and statesman. The same ingenious arts of giving verisimilitude to a fiction are practiced in both dialogues, and in both, as well as in the myth at the end of the Republic, Plato touches on the subject of necessity and free will. The words in which he describes the miseries of states seem to be an amplification of the cities, will never cease from ill of the Republic. The point of view in both is the same, and the difference is not really important, e.g. in the myth, or in the account of the different kinds of states. But the treatment of the subject in The Statesman is fragmentary, and the shorter and later work, as might be expected, is less finished, and less worked out in detail. The idea of measure and the arrangement of the sciences supply connecting links both with the Republic and the Philebus. More than any of the preceding dialogues, The Statesman seems to approximate in thought and language to the Lawers. There is the same decline and tendency to monotony in style, the same self-consciousness, awkwardness, and over-civility, and in the Lawers, is contained the pattern of that second-best form of government, which, after all, is admitted to be the only attainable one in this world. The gentle violence, the marriage of dissimilar natures, the figure of the warp and the woof, are also found in the Lawers. Both expressly recognize the conception of a first or ideal state, which has receded into an invisible heaven. Nor does the account of the origin and growth of society really differ in them, if we make allowance for the mythic character of the narrative in The Statesman. The virtuous tyrant is common to both of them, and the elitic stranger takes up a position similar to that of the Athenian stranger in the Lawers. There would have been little disposition to doubt the genuineness of the sophist and statesman, if they had been compared with the Lawers, rather than with the Republic, and the Lawers had been received, as they ought to be, on the authority of Aristotle, and on the ground of their intrinsic excellence, as an undoubted work of Plato. The detailed consideration of the genuineness and order of the Platonic dialogues has been reserved for another place. A few of the reasons for defending the sophist and statesman may be given here. 1. The excellence, importance, and metaphysical originality of the two dialogues. No works at once so good, and of such length, are known to have proceeded from the hands of a forger. 2. The resemblances in them to other dialogues of Plato are such as might be expected to be found in works of the same author, and not in those of an imitator, being too subtle and minute to have been invented by another. The similar passages and turns of thought are generally inferior to the parallel passages in his earlier writings, and we might a priori have expected that, if altered, they would have been improved. But the comparison of the Lawers proves that this repetition of his own thoughts and words in an inferior form is characteristic of Plato's later style. 3. The close connection of them with the Theaetetus, Parmenides, and Philebus involves the fate of these dialogues, as well as of the two suspected ones. 4. The suspicion of them seems mainly to rest on a presumption that in Plato's writings we may expect to find an uniform type of doctrine and opinion. But however we arrange the order, or narrow the circle of the dialogues, we must admit that they exhibit a growth and progress in the mind of Plato, and the appearance of change or progress is not to be regarded as impugning the genuineness of any particular writings, but maybe even an argument in their favor. If we suppose the sophist and Politicus to stand halfway between the Republic and the Lawers, and in near connection with the Theaetetus, the Parmenides, the Philebus, the arguments against them derived from differences of thought and style disappear, or may be said without paradox in some degree to confirm their genuineness. There is no such interval between the Republic or Phaedrus and the two suspected dialogues, as that which separates all the earlier writings of Plato from the Lawers. And the Theaetetus, Parmenides, and Philebus supply links, by which, however different from them, they may be reunited with the great body of the Platonic writings.